The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 117.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show, a very good friend of mine. He is one of the smartest guys in the entire macro space, that is for sure. His name is Jason Burke. He's with Wall Street for Main Street. Jason, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Thanks, George. And you brought me back quickly because I saw you use my stagflation tax and lie thesis for part three of your video from last Friday.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I've been using that a lot lately. Actually, I used it on that video, but I've done, you know, I usually do maybe five or six interviews per week on other people's podcasts and whatnot. And I've been talking about that a lot lately. I give you credit every time, but you just nailed it. I mean, I don't think I've heard of a term that hits the nail on the head better than stagflate, tax, and lie when we reference what the government's game plan is, or most probable game plan. So I think after that whiteboard video, you reached out to me on Twitter and said, hey, listen, I think what we need to do is we need to tell people how they can protect themselves, how they can build wealth and thrive in a world of out of control central banks and big governments that want to pick their pocket and want to create this stagflate tax and lie environment. So I said, let's do it, dude. Let's do it ASAP. So you put together just a fantastic chart deck that I'm going to have my editor reference this whole time. So do you want to just start walking us through this? I think this is going to just provide tremendous value to the viewer and the listener.
Sure. A little background first for stagflating tax and lie. This is something that took me over 10 years to figure out, of doing an enormous amount of reading, thousands of articles, over 500 books about business economics and investing, lots of video lectures from the Mises Institute YouTube channel, listening to interviews of over 500 experts, and then just a ton of research and analysis and questioning what I believed, you know, listening to different experts, whether that's Jeffrey Snyder or Richard Duncan, who are not Austrian school or free market or libertarian, and just seeing if they understood certain parts of the global financial system better than I did, and just trying to put all the pieces to the puzzle together. The other important aspect was financial history.
Yeah.
So history does not repeat exactly, but it does rhyme. And I think that's a common theme, is that governments will tend to go back to similar things that they did in the past, especially from the Great Depression in 1929 and the 1970 stagflation. I think we could get a really bad combination of both.
Okay, so we start off with this, how to survive and thrive in a stagflate, tax and lie environment. Appropriately enough, you've got the elephant and the donkey representing the two parties of the political system with their hands in the pockets of the taxpayer. That is absolutely perfect. So why don't you start off with outlining this next page, what books to study about similar periods of currency debasement in history?
Yeah, so I think this is important if your listeners want to dig deep on this, is to see how people reacted in the past, whether that was the Weimar Republic, German hyperinflation, or more recently, what's happened in either Zimbabwe or Venezuela. And also similar aspects are to socialist countries with Cuba, where in Venezuela, where a lot of people there have degrees, they have master's degrees or PhD degrees, and yet their currency is being intentionally destroyed. Now, The tax situation is not the same there, but normally governments, and this is, again, going back to financial history, governments like to do a combination of currency debasement, devaluation, which is monetary inflation, and then also tax schemes. So they work hand in hand. I think the average analyst out there does not look at a combination of the reality of inflation plus the taxes. You have to combine the two.
And then the lying, they completely ignore that. And correct me if I'm wrong, Jason, but the lying part of your thesis is all about saying the CPI is, let's say, 2% when in reality it's 10. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. The Chapwood Inflation Index, I don't think they've updated it in 2020 yet, but it was expanding on John Williams' Shadow Stats work. I've interviewed Ed Batowski in the past. So maybe you can have Ed Batowski on for an interview. The Chapwood Inflation Index, he was surveying, I think, twice a year, 500 different consumer goods in every major metro area. And he's been tracking, I think, since 2014 or 15, the real inflation rate has been 7 to 14%, I think, in most major metro areas.
Yeah, and that sounds right to me, just based on what I buy daily at the grocery store or just out and about. I mean, that seems like it's a much better or a much more accurate reflection than just 2% per year, which is almost nothing. Okay, cool. So going back to this slide here, you want to keep going through. It looks like we've got fiat money inflation in France. So you're really combining just everything that we've seen with hyperinflation or severe inflation in the past.
Yeah, so hyperinflation events are psychological and you need velocity of money. But I think it's important to go back with a book like When Money Dies, which is available on audiobook. Just hearing the people, hearing the stories of the people in there who were doing foreign currency trading, who are trying to figure out how to grow their income while their German mark was being destroyed. So I think that's something that our listeners are going to have to understand, because what these governments and central banks are doing, George, is financial repression. So the normal safe ways of getting 5 or 6% income in the past by just buying U.S. treasuries for a retiree and being able to put their savings into something that's quote unquote risk free and getting return in the past and being able to live off the interest from that, those days are gone. Because the governments and the central banks, especially the governments, do not want to cut back. So the governments are not sharing in the sacrifice. You're hearing local and state politicians talking about tax increases and property tax increases, whether that's the mayor of Chicago or elsewhere. So, and people are going to be getting less services, less government services for their currency. So they are going to get less, and people are going to have to maintain their standard of living. They're going to have to fight. They're going to have to be entrepreneurial. They're going to have to learn to play offense and defense. And by reading some of these books, whether that's America's Great Depression by Murray Rothbard, which I think is the truth about what really happened in the Great Depression, and I'm a history major, not what happened in the generalist history books, or the Forgotten Man. The Forgotten Man by Amity Schles is great. That is a great book about what really happened during the Great Depression, how the government was forcing wage and price controls. And if this crisis does continue, George, and things get bad enough, we could have more wage and price controls implemented too by politicians to either buy votes or to try to keep people happy and prevent more civil unrest.
Wow. What do you think will be their main point of attack in regards to taxes? Do you see it just straight across the board, or do you see them going a little easy on the income tax and then getting more hardcore with a wealth tax or capital gains, property taxes? What do you see there as your base case?
Well, history says they try to target the rich, but normally the rich can avoid the taxes. So it's the middle class that gets clobbered the most, the middle or upper middle or working class that gets clobbered the most with stagflation or currency debasement. Back in the past with gold and silver coins, it was coin clipping and then taxes. But with the current state of the economy right now, because it is a disaster and there is a cash flow problem, I think the easiest targets for governments right now, especially at the state and local levels here in the U.S., are property taxes for actual real estate owners, because they can't move the real estate. Now, you can sell the real estate, you know this, George, but you can't move the real estate. So property taxes are one thing that I think governments, because they don't want to cut back on their budgets or spending, a lot of government employees are not talking about shared sacrifice. And the other major tax, I think, because of the state of the economy right now, and the economy is not generating, I call it a cash flow problem. There's cash flow problems at all levels of society. Governments are not getting their tax revenues. The consumer is not earning a good income through economic activity. Businesses are not earning, a lot of businesses are in trouble. So I think we could see politicians try to, they're going to go where the spending is, and a lot of the spending is online. So I think in the not too distant future, we could see, we've already heard Andrew Yang talk about this when he was a presidential candidate. He was talking about around a 10%, I think, value added tax. Japan and other countries already have that. So I could see a national online sales tax or a value added tax for online purchases in the not too distant future, because that's where a lot of the spending is being diverted. So I think the two main ones we could see are property tax hikes, which are normal, even when the economy is doing well, but they shouldn't hike property taxes right now because of the state of the economy. And then also a national online sales tax or value added tax for online sales, because that's where the majority of the consumer spending is coming from.
Those are great points. I want to unpack the property tax just a little bit further. And I think you and I were talking a couple months ago, maybe it was via Twitter, and you had a fantastic point where, and I think you pointed this out with a news article or something like that. Hopefully this will refresh your memory. But you were talking something to the effect that they're not just going out and saying, okay, we're going to take your property taxes from, let's say, 1.5% to 2%. It's not like in your face. It's more kind of a back door that goes back to tax or stagflate tax and lie, in the sense that they'll just reappraise the value of the property for a higher level, even though your purchasing power didn't increase. And so they're collecting more property taxes, which is a higher percentage of your overall income, although they're not just coming out and explicitly saying, we're increasing your property taxes. Do you remember that conversation we had?
Yeah, I think, and I've seen that you mentioned this on videos where like the nominal value of real estate keeps going up every couple of years. And this is what happens when you devalue currencies, is that hard assets, traditional hard assets such as gold, silver, and real estate are going to eventually start rising in price, noticing the currency debasement.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
So the mathematical scheme then is they don't have to necessarily hike the property taxes too much. They can hike them a little bit, but if the value of the property is rising in nominal value, they're going to get more of it.
Yeah. But just to be clear for those who aren't following that, Jason made the point of saying nominal. So, and why that's so important is because people see the value of their home going up and they think they're just getting rich. But what they don't understand is if it's just going up with the rate of inflation, your purchasing power, which is what's really important, isn't going up at all. So if you're paying more out of pocket with those property taxes, again, that's a decrease, that's a transfer of wealth from the property owner to the government, which is obviously what they want. Okay, so next slide here, we're talking about solution number one, playing championship caliber defense. Be your own central banker. I love the way how you set it up with defense and offense.
Yeah, I think that's done. I did that intentionally so it's easier to understand, because normally if you're going to be good at sports, you have to be, most sports don't have special teams, so it's offense or defense. Mm-hmm. And if you're good at both, you have a chance of succeeding. So in terms of the defense here, it's trying to defend against currency devaluation and taxes, because the lying about the economic data is, you know, it's not as important for the defensive part. The lying about the economic data is replacing your income. So you're just protecting yourself also against bail-ins too from the banks. And the bail-ins are not guaranteed. This is something that my friend James Anderson at SD Bullion has studied more extensively than me, but central banks have their own savings. So they have reserves, they have dollars and gold. And so people, and obviously in the banking system, long-term, you don't want to hold a lot of dollars, but there could be opportunities if there is another stock market crash and there's quality companies that go on sale, or we're having a little bit of a dip now in some of the gold stocks, some of the better gold stocks, maybe there's a correction of 20%, who knows? And you want cash for optionality. So long-term, your cash is going to be devalued or debased by the people in power, the central bankers and the governments, because this is part of stagflation, tax and lie. But you need cash in the short term to take advantage of opportunities when assets do go on sale.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But so many people struggle with that. They're like, man, I don't want to have this cash because I'm really worried about inflation decreasing my purchasing power. It's like you've got this cash that's being devalued against the stuff that you're buying daily, but with the hopes of it appreciating in value against assets. And that's the balancing act.
Yes, and the physical gold and silver, and I also have gold stocks in there too in the slide deck, and maybe a little bit of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. I view that as a little bit of an insurance policy in case of gold and silver, because we don't know if the tax situation is going to change for owners of physical gold and silver. Let's say gold goes to way over $5,000 an ounce or way over $10,000 an ounce. We don't know what the politicians and the bureaucrats and the U.S. Treasury are going to decide to do. Now, as of now, for American citizens, it's a 28% tax on gold and silver if they decide to sell it. And that doesn't seem that much, but compared to the long-term capital gains taxes on buying and holding real estate or buying and holding stocks, that is a lot higher. And Joe Biden, if he does win the election, and you know, I'm not voting for Joe Biden, but if he does win the election, he has a tax proposal plan in place, George, to massively increase as of now. And who knows if Wall Street's going to agree to this, or who knows what other bribes he's going to have to give Wall Street, what other payoffs or bribes for them to agree to this, or they might not agree to it at all. But as of now, in his tax plan, there's calling for massive amounts of tax increases for capital gains taxes on stocks, and also capital gains, and also much higher taxes on dividends. So having savings out of the system, and not just all in stocks and all in the banking system, is safe. It protects against the tax component, because in an environment with stagflation, tax and lie, the government doesn't want to cut back. And so it's going after anyone with assets. So real estate, like we discussed earlier, or stocks.
Yeah, yeah. And then you make a point here that physical gold and silver are not investments, especially for American citizens who have metal taxed or ordinary at ordinary income, or 28%. Yeah, the point you just made. All right. We go down. The next one is bank bailouts, bank bail-ins, or some combination are all a possibility.
Yeah, so I credit my friend James Anderson, SD Bullion, for finding this. Christine Lagarde, when she was the head of the IMF, started putting in these supranational laws, which are above the normal country laws. And this is something that, like, the Bank of International Settlements, the IMF, and the World Bank obviously were coordinating on, preparing for the next global financial crisis. And there's still the laws on the books of potential bank bail-ins, where depositors at U.S. banks are viewed as creditors, unsecured creditors. So that means that they're technically, if the globalist organization that is the IMF or the World Bank or the Bank of International Settlements, they would fight what the U.S. government would want to do with the FDIC. Because remember, the FDIC guarantees a certain amount of people's deposits. So there's clearly fights going on behind the scenes over what to do in the next crisis. And this is being fought over now for the last 6 years by the elites over whether or not the bank depositors should be fully bailed out or partially bailed out. And there's the possibility, I'm not 100% in the bank bail-in camp. I think there's a possibility. There could also be some type of weird combination where maybe the shareholders of bank stocks get some type of bailout, or the executives of the banks, because the banks are holding the derivatives. So I don't think the large banks are going to be allowed to fail because of the amount of derivatives that most of the large banks have. So again, we're at a point in history right now where the rules can literally change daily. There's been so many rules changes, George, just since mid to end of February, that it's tough to keep track of them all. I know other financial professionals that spend they get paid to do this, to look for all the rules changes, and they can't keep up with all the rules changes, because I talk to them and ask them what they think of these rules changes, and they were like, I wasn't aware that rule was changed. So that's how quickly things are. And the average person on Main Street, this is really, really difficult for them. This is not fair. And this is just more rules changes here. So as of now, people's deposits to a certain amount are guaranteed with the FDIC, but there's globalist laws in place that could potentially change that.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Do you think this is an argument to keep some dry powder in the form of T-bills instead of in a bank account?
Yeah, that's a possibility. I think this is more for physical gold and silver out of the system, and also maybe a little bit of Bitcoin and some cryptocurrency.
Okay, got it.
Because those are more liquid than selling bonds. I don't buy and trade bonds. The U.S. Treasury market is very liquid. I'm not as familiar with selling bonds. I don't buy or own any bonds. I'm not a big fan of them.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I'm not. I think they're in a huge bubble, but for just to keep some liquidity, if you're thinking, okay, well, I've got, let's say, $1 million in cash, or I've got $500,000, I'm worried about having all of it in the banking system to where my counterparty is Wells Fargo or B of A, something like that, because of what you're talking about with these bail-ins. So maybe I'll take $250 and put it into short-term T-bills, like 3-month T-bills, and just keep rolling it over until there's an opportunity, because I'd rather, although I don't like the counterparty risk there being the government and inflation, I'd rather take that risk every 3 months than have a counterparty of Deutsche Bank if you're in Europe, or Wells Fargo, B of A, something like that. Yeah. All right. So the next slide we have, solution number two. We're talking about the offense now. Be entrepreneurial to grow income to offset currency devaluation and tax increases. Great point here. We want to be a price maker and not a price taker.
And this is something that I'm doing myself with my own investor education and research business. And from a lot of growing pains, many years to get the business successful, growing income is not easy at all. It requires a lot of skills. You have to convince people that you know what you're doing. So, but I really believe, George, that everyone is good at something. But unfortunately, if you study financial history, a lot of people did not adapt well to past financial crises where the governments were debasing or devaluing the currency and increasing taxes. And one of the common themes, besides saving out of the currency system, was people did not have the plan in place to grow their income until it was too late, until the inflation rate was already taking off. So if people already have the plan in place, they've talked it over with friends and family, they've decided that I'm good at this one skill, my friend or family member is good at another skill and has experience here, maybe we can do a little side hustle or side business and get a little extra income coming in. And then maybe after a certain number of years, maybe the side business takes off and turns into a full-time job, although that's very, very hard. But even a side business or side hustle can help offset that stagflation tax and lie and help people maintain their standard of living. And unfortunately, George, I think a lot of people who are comfortable now, who are doing pretty well now, they're going to be the target of politicians and bureaucrats, because that's what history has told us. Is that initially the politicians do the populist argument that, oh, we're only going to go after the billionaires, we're only going to go after the rich. But what history says is that normally the billionaires or the rich dodge a lot of those taxes and the rules and regulations and the other crazy stuff that politicians and bureaucrats can do. And the brunt of the stagflation tax and lie with the extra tax increases and the currency debasement, it falls onto the upper middle class, working class.
Yep, that's right. I mean, there's just not, even if they could round up all the rich people, there's not enough money there. I mean, you can tax them 100% and it's still only going to pay for the government for what, 3 months or something like that. It's just kind of a battle cry from the politicians just to buy votes, win votes. And people think that all our problems would be solved if the rich, quote unquote, would just share their wealth with the rest of us. And unfortunately, that's not true. We need to grow the pie. We don't need to slice it up and divide it. That's not the answer. As an example, Jason, let's use your Patreon page, and I'd suggest everybody go check it out. Can you walk us through how you started that and then what your background was and what your experience has been so far? So other people that are maybe thinking about doing that with whatever skill set they have, you know, as an example, I've got a real good buddy who's been selling cars and he's really, really good. But I have been trying to get him to start a YouTube channel to teach consumers how to buy a used car. He's just got so much knowledge in that area. And whether you're a dentist, whether you're a teacher, whether you sell cars, no matter what you do, to your earlier point, you've got knowledge and information that other people don't have and that they actually want. How did you set up this Patreon page? What was the genesis and how has it gone so far?
It's gone very well in the last like 6 to 8 months. It's really taken off. A lot of it's because you've been promoting my work.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to, because it's fantastic information. But as far as someone setting up a Patreon page for themselves or monetizing a YouTube channel, how would you suggest they go about that?
Well, first you have to put in the work. You have to add the skills. So I have listed here on the slide that there's a lot of cheap ways now to learn. So there's used books. Hardly anyone wants to buy used books anymore. Those are really cheap. Libraries are giving them away. There's audiobooks, YouTube videos, podcasts. You have Udemy, Khan Academy, Masterclass, Skillshare, plenty of other places to learn for free or cheaply, but it's hard work. It's hard work learning or mastering or even becoming pretty decent at new skills. It's hard work starting a little side business and growing income. And the tough part with me was I was always doing the research and putting in the hard work. It was just tough figuring out how to get people to chip in and pay for it. And the problem is, one of the problems, George, honestly, is YouTube, because it's really tough to consistently grow your channel, add new subscribers, and the Google AdWords revenues on YouTube are extremely inconsistent. So at one point I was earning over $2,000 a month from Google AdWords revenues on YouTube, and this was around the 2016 election, and then they took it down to almost zero with no warning. So YouTube, I think the way to use YouTube is like as a loss leader for content marketing. So your friend there, if he's an expert at something, he may need to partner with someone who is good at marketing or who can get people to pay. So he does his thing with his showing people how to do, someone films him and he shows people step by step, either how to buy a used car or how to sell them, whatever skill he's good at. And then someone else, this is not everyone's good at everything. So I didn't have all these skills. I had to read a lot of extra books about marketing. It was trial and error. It was very difficult for a long period of time. I mean, I was working day jobs and hustling with side projects and hustling with part-time work while I was building this business on the side. I worked day jobs I did not like in the financial industry with bosses who hated everything I said.
Yeah. But the bottom line is you put in the work and then you've got this, I don't know if it's a side hustle. I think it's a proper business where you can do from anywhere in the world. You just need an internet connection. But I think going back to our original point with the theme of this video is you're able to be in control of the prices you charge. So if we have inflation go up by 100% over the next year, let's say, because of money printing or whatever, they get velocity up, you're able to just adjust your prices to match that. But someone that's out there that's an employee, they're not able to just go to their employer and say, hey, look, employer, shadow stats said that inflation increased by 100%. Go ahead and just double my pay really quick, please.
Yeah, and I totally agree, George.
That's the difference here that I really want to drive home with everyone listening to this.
Yes, also taxes can be increased, and I'm anti-fragile in the sense that I have over 1,000 people now per month chipping in a little bit.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
So if a couple people cancel or it's money is tight and a couple dozen people cancel, you know, I'm not financially ruined. So this way I get to provide value to people at a reasonable price. I'm not overcharging anyone. My newsletter is not $5,000 a year or higher or anything like that. I'm charging $5 a month. Now, like you said, if inflation does get a problem, then I might hike my prices just a little bit to offset some of my costs. But overall, I want to keep the content and the research affordable because that's one of the goals of my company. The goal of my company is to take all this difficult to understand stuff through financial history and listening to all these experts and all these books and put it into much easier to understand terms. And that's how I came up with Stagflate and Tax and Lie after many years of research and listening to experts and studying financial history.
Yeah. One thing I want to add really quick before we move on is you were talking about how it's a lot of work to do this research, which it absolutely 100% is. But I would also encourage people to think about what they enjoy doing. And I'll use myself as an example. In 2012, as you know, I didn't know anything about macro. I didn't know what the Fed was. I didn't know what a yield curve. I mean, absolutely zero. But I just really dove into it because I loved it. I absolutely loved every minute of listening to whatever audiobook, whatever YouTube video, podcast, you name it. It's just what I did. So if I was in the shower, I was listening to a podcast, a macro podcast. If I was eating dinner, if I was on an airplane, if I was jogging, if I was at the gym, that's just what I was always doing. That's what I wanted to do. You didn't have to force me. That's what my preference was. So when I started this YouTube channel, you know, when I go on here and talk to people like you or do the whiteboard videos, I would be talking about that stuff regardless of whether or not I had a YouTube channel. It's just having the YouTube channel lets me talk about it with other people who are like-minded. So yes, it is a lot of work. That's for sure. When I do a YouTube video, especially a whiteboard video, it takes about 12 hours. But as far as, you know, if you can find a niche that you really enjoy, then it's just, it makes it so much better. And it makes everything much more fun, while at the same time giving you a hedge against inflation and everything that we've been referring to. So I'll set that aside from now. I think everyone gets it. Now, you've got some books here that, oh, good, you've got books to go along with what we were just talking about. Okay, fantastic. And what I would add to this, too, if people are interested, is a YouTube channel called Miles Beckler. Really good guy, a buddy of mine, and he gives away all his content for free. So if you're thinking about starting a blog, a podcast, a YouTube channel, definitely start there. Miles Beckler is the guy's name. And then final thoughts. Do you want to go over that quickly, Jason? I know you're a little short on time.
Yeah, so studying financial history with whether it was the German hyperinflation, the Weimar Republic, or Zimbabwe, or Venezuela, there was a lot of people who actually were good at one or the other. Normally it was growing income. So people for a while, they were good at growing income. They were not good at playing defense. It's very tough to have both skills. And this is something that in financial history, when you study like past Great Depressions and what the politicians decided to do here in the US with wage and price controls, how FDR, because there was too much deflation, he ended deflation very quickly by changing the rules. And at this point, George, until the economy gets back to producing normal levels of cash flow, all that's left is bailouts and rules changes. So people have to understand that they're going to have the skills here for offense and defense. But studying financial history, this is something that people did not have both of. So it's a lot of work to put it in to grow your income and to understand financial history. The defense part, if your listeners have savings, the defense part is going to be a lot easier. The growing the income part, especially if someone already has a good job, that's going to be tougher because that means then that they're not going to be able to take as much time off to maintain their standard of living. And they're going to have to replace the purchasing power and the income that's going to be stolen from stagflation, tax and lie, from currency debasement and higher taxes. It's an important point you brought up about employees. So if people are earning a high income right now, even people earning six or seven figures a year, they're going to be the target probably of politicians and bureaucrats with higher taxes. So just because Trump is talking about a temporary payroll tax doesn't mean that that's going to last very long. And things could reverse very quickly depending upon who wins the election, or a year or two from now, you could see a lot more taxes layered on.
But also too, Jason, you know, they changed the CPI metric they use for the tax brackets.
So yes, I've seen that video. It's an excellent video. The other part about financial history, George, is the wage and price controls. So a lot of people are not aware of this, but you had the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act. So we're in a situation now where the U.S. and China are going to be going tit for tat, back and forth, a game of retaliation. So all of the, whether it's global currency debasement, different countries devaluing their currency, higher minimum wage laws, retaliatory tariffs, all these things are going to put higher costs in the global supply chain. And right now, the global economy is not producing the same level of goods and services it was prior to February. So right. There's going to be more currency and credit chasing the same or fewer goods and services. And if you add in taxes too, that's going to be stagflationary. Not for every single item, because in the Austrian School of Economics, there's the Cantillon effect. And the Cantillon effect means that prices do not rise evenly. It's whoever's getting the currency and credit first. So a lot of that currency and credit is going into certain asset prices. It's going into certain consumer goods, whereas other consumer goods, there is no demand for right now because people don't have discretionary income or they're practicing social distancing.
Jason, I appreciate your time. I know you got to get on to other things today. So for my viewers who want to find out more about what you do and the research that you put up on Patreon, where can they go to check that out?
Just go to the Wall Street for Main Street YouTube channel. There is over a decade worth of free content there. Lots of interviews with experts, some of the really big name ones that you also interview, also short videos and live stream shows. So there's a lot of free content there. And a link to my Patreon page is also there as well. If people want to take a look at the research behind the paywall, it is only $5 a month. I think it's the best deal out there. There's articles on warning about risks about uranium investing, the oil market. There's audio podcasts about the
gold
royalty streaming
too.
Company.
Gold miners. I mean, you're an expert in gold miners.
Yep. Eric Sprott and Sprott flew me up twice to Toronto in 2014 and 2016 to meet them.
Yeah. All right, buddy. I appreciate it. Can't wait to do it again.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.